think my remarks are going to focus on initiatives, a framework that can help economic progress and social progress in Latin America. From what can the U.S. do in the post-Bush era to actually encourage more growth and also address the inequities and the poverty that previous speakers have alluded to. Okay, so now what do we do? They want us to... I do have a PowerPoint, so if... I think, you know, the first point I want to make is that I think we have to put the policy with the incoming administration in the context that the U.S. is facing right now, which is the very likely economic slowdown, possible recession that the U.S. might face, which some people think it's going to be short-lived, but we really don't know. Some people think it may be actually protracted. And that will generate a particular context, both economically and politically, towards the region. The recession is going to create, or the slowdown is going to create, hardship for many groups of the population in the U.S. that are going to see their living, they're already seeing their living standards falling and their net worth falling. And I think this will generate sort of an intensification of the anti-trade, anti-migration, anti-outsourcing sentiments within the U.S., and that's going to be one of the main challenges for any administration that wants to have a progressive agenda towards the region, because there may be some trade-offs. There may be some zero-sum games in some quarters here. So I think that the two main challenges, I would say, for the incoming administration is going to be how to resist the isolationist pressures and avoid going backwards towards the region, and how to advance simultaneously a cooperative agenda, and what should this agenda look like. I wanted to share with you some pieces of information about what we expect in terms of what the region looks like now, or what might happen as a result of this slowdown in the U.S. The order of magnitude of the effect on the countries will depend, of course, on what happens in the U.S. By some estimates, every 1% decline in GDP in the U.S. causes about a 0.6% decline on average in the region, with some countries facing a much sharper decline. For instance, Mexico, which is very dependent on U.S. exports, it can see its economy decline by 1.5% for each 1% decline in the U.S. Central America is also going to be hurt more, and some of the Caribbean countries. So there's going to be a diverse impact in terms of overall growth, and also remittances. The channels through which we're going to see the impact of what happens in the U.S. can be of various kinds. One is, of course, how much countries rely on exports, how much countries rely on remittances, and what's going to be the impact of the U.S. slowdown on commodity prices and global growth, because a lot of the countries are seeing currently a boom that is primarily based on the extraordinary increase in commodity prices that have resulted as a result of global growth. Some countries, one thing that's different in Latin America, thank God, in the 2000s, is that the macroeconomic conditions are much more robust than they were in the past, so we don't foresee any type of major crisis as we had in the 1980s or the 1990s or even early 2000s, but some of them may face macroeconomic difficulties. I think that also, in the short term, we're going to see living standards in some households sort of declining quite sharply, depending on how much they depend on remittances and how much remittances will be affected. So the good news about Latin America is what Mark Weisbrot referred to earlier, is that, if you look at what happened in the 80s and 90s, it didn't do very well in general, but in the last 4 or 5 years, it was doing very well. Growth has been picking up in many of the countries, with the exception of Mexico. We can go into that but I don't think we have to focus on it. But it's too bad that the country that actually bet on integrating with the U.S. is the one that's doing the worst. It's remarkable, in fact. not necessarily a causal link there, but it's interesting. Then, you know, commodity prices have continued to soar, and for many countries that's good news. And although, you know, we see a lot of volatility, one week things go up, when they go down, they still are up there, and as long as China continues to grow, people expect them to continue to be there. Countries have strengthened their public finances. As you can see, this is the non-interest balance as a percentage of GDP, so they have surpluses to cope with the situation in the region. The debt to GDP ratios have declined, which is good in terms of macroeconomic robustness. But significant vulnerabilities remain. I mean, here you can see the exposure to commodity prices by country. I mean, clearly Venezuela and Argentina are doing very well, and I mean, Chile, but, you know, they rely very heavily on what happens to commodity prices. And what we have seen over the years is that even small changes can unravel situations when they're not very, when they're held with pins. And so we shouldn't be too surprised if prices begin to fall in some of the commodities that things will become not so pretty, particularly in Venezuela and Argentina. Those are the most vulnerable to that. Mexico is not very vulnerable in terms of commodity prices, but it is vulnerable in terms of exports to the U.S. This is, you know, a percentage of exports sent to the U.S. as a percentage of total exports by country, and, you know, Mexico is way up because that's, you know, the main trading partner that Mexico has is the U.S. And other countries are much more diversified. So you have, you know, some being more vulnerable on the commodity side, commodity prices side, others more vulnerable on the dependence on U.S. Markets, and some sort of in between both. But, you know, they all have some of it. And one thing that's worrisome is that in some countries we see inflation rising, and that means that the degree of maneuver to respond to a slowdown is curtailed. Because one of the things that you want to avoid during the U.S. slowdown is to see, even if it doesn't cause a crisis, you want countries to be able to kind of avoid a slowdown that would be hurtful for the population in Latin America. But inflation puts a curb on that. They're asking me to speak a little. I thought it was my time up, but it's I need to get closer to the mic. Sorry. Okay, and here is, you know, what's happening. You know, some countries, most of the South American countries, continue to grow, even if the U.S. decelerates. But here we have the U.S. and Mexico, and probably if you had Central America, those which are more sensitive to exporting to the U.S. are seeing their economies already decelerating. So we do have that as a context, and this will require a particular type of response. And some of the projections of what may happen in terms of percent of GDP, like I said, nothing earth-shaking, but there will be an expected slowdown, which could be much worse if the U.S. situation worsens, and we certainly don't know how worse it will get. And here, you know, I just wanted to give you some idea of, you know, Mexico, which is not the country that relies the most on remittances from those who are heavily dependent on remittances, because for Central America and some Caribbean countries, remittances represent between 10 and 20% of GDP, so they have a macroeconomic impact, not just on living standards. But Mexico, which has 3.5%, it's $24 billion, is, you know, about 60% of oil revenues. Also going into the country. And one of the things that people have seen is that these definitely have an effect on poor people. About a third of the remittances go to municipalities that have a degree of marginality, which means they're very poor, either high or very high. So anything that happens to remittances is going to have a direct impact on poverty. And therefore, this is going to be an unequalizing slowdown, by the way. I mean, inequality is probably going to increase unless, you know, the top incomes also get hurt very much, but we don't see that necessarily happening. So what I think should be the U.S. Sort of policy that can help the region? In fact, you know, one of the first and foremost policies that can help the region is whatever the U.S. does to contain its own economic slowdown, will be very important for the region. So welcome to any of the initiatives that have been taken by either the administration or the Fed to avoid a major breakdown. The other thing is that to the extent that the U.S. can implement targeted safety nets to those which are most affected by its own slowdown, I think it will help not only economically, but also will help politically to contain the backlash that I was referring initially in terms of isolationist tendencies. And I haven't seen much of that, but eventually I think the U.S. policy will have to deal with what happens with increasing unemployment, with the home foreclosures for the poor and the lower middle classes, etc. And that will be a very important, I think, component domestically to address this issue. And the other one that I think is very important is that the U.S. does not introduce protectionist measures vis-a-vis exports from the region. I mean, we may not like the free trade agreements as they were developed, but I don't think that going back in terms of reversing some of the opening that has already taken place will be helpful. No, it will be damaging. And in the process of economic slowdown for the countries, it will be even more forceful in terms of exacerbating the negative impact on the economies in the region. So this has to be avoided. I also wanted to add that given that there's going to be probably an impact on the poorest sectors of the population of the slowdown felt first in the region, particularly through remittances, but also subsequently through the slowdown, overall slowdown in growth, that you know an agenda that in the multilaterals emphasizes any kind of programs that could help cushion the blow on these groups might be very helpful, which also the U.S. can help by supporting it. Now, beyond the conjuncture, I think beyond you know thinking beyond this current situation in which we hope will be short-lived in terms of the slowdown of the U.S. economy, I think that here, you know, I put the case of Mexico, Canada within NAFTA, but we can extend this approach to other agreements, is that probably we need to create a different type of institutional umbrella that will allow to go back to the agreements and see what things need to be reviewed and revised to make them work better for the countries involved, without killing them. I mean, one thing that should be avoided is a unilateral approach from, I know that we're in a sort of electoral season, but unilateral approaches would be very bad for the region if any of the new incoming administration would say, well, either you take what we want from you in the agreement or we renege, that would be terrible. But I think you have to find a workable space where you can make changes without feeling threatened that this will be the end of the agreements. I think, for example, Mexico might have to revisit some of the things that have to do with industrial policy in order to overcome some of the bottlenecks that now it doesn't allow it to grow faster, and maybe you know it cannot do it within the current rules of NAFTA, so it probably will have to change some of that if we want to see differences coming up. The other thing is that I think the U.S. should have sort of an open mind to the new approaches to redistributive policies that are taking place in the region. You know, we see these new initiatives like land reform in Bolivia, and rather than sort of feeling threatened by things like that, I think we need to look at them with a different approach, because a lot of the inequality that has been in Latin America for five centuries results from the concentration of distribution of assets, particularly for a long period land, and in some of the countries that's still very important. Also, you know, the tax reform in Ecuador, which has become pretty progressive and has many ingredients that even you know more mainstream economists welcome, I think could be helped if the U.S. supports it, for example, through tax agreements to improve the chances that taxes on global incomes can become effective. It has one with Mexico, but it'd be good to push that agenda throughout the region, particularly when, like Ecuador, they have introduced now the idea of taxing global incomes. But if they don't have the cooperation of where the incomes go, then it's going to be very hard. So that's, you know, something very specific. And finally, I mean, everybody has said that, and it sounds nice and a little bit, you know, maybe difficult to think how it's going to be grounded, but here there's people who have worked on this for decades now, is how can you think of an integration process that will be more cooperative and inclusive, which will include the dimensions that now, so far, have been totally left out of the table, which is migration and cohesion funds. I think that, you know, this is hard to discuss in times of economic slowdown in the U.S. or possible recession, because people want anything that's going to be there available to help the people within the U.S., and we understand that. But in the longer term, I think the process of integration has to be approached with a view to reducing the differences in income per capita within the region, and also reducing the differences in income per capita in the countries in the region. Thank you very much.